vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
I live in Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. While the ceasefire continues to hold between Israel and Gaza, Israel's cracking down on Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank, occupied East Jerusalem, and inside Israel. The newspaper Haaretz reports Israeli police have arrested nearly 2,000 Palestinians over the past month in an attempt to quell protests and uprisings against the occupation. On Saturday, Israeli police arrested Al Jazeera reporter Guevara Buderi as she covered a protest in Sheikh Jarrah. During the arrest, officers broke her hand and destroyed the equipment of her camera operator. She was also reportedly beaten while being taken to an Israeli police interrogation center. On Sunday, police in East Jerusalem detained both Muna and Mohammed El-Kurd. The 23-year-old twins have been helping to lead efforts to fight the eviction of Palestinians living in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem, where their families live. Jewish settlers already live in part of their home. Mohammed spoke out after he and his sister were released Sunday night.
What happened today was a clear tactic of intimidation. The Israeli occupation clearly doesn't want anybody to be speaking about the abuses it's doing against the Palestinian residents in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. But we are not afraid. We are unintimidated, and we're going to continue to speak out against all of these injustices, and we're going to continue to protect our homes.
Just as we went to air on Democracy Now!, residents of Sheikh Jarrah were dealt a legal setback, making it more likely the Palestinians will be evicted. We go now to the West Bank city of Ramallah, where we're joined by Mariam Barghouti, a Palestinian writer and researcher. Mariam, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what the Israeli Attorney General just ruled.
Hi, thank you for having me again, Amy. So right now, the Attorney General of Israel basically said that they will not be involved with the case of Sheikh Jarrah, and the decision is left to the Israeli Supreme Court. The excuse is that the case of the families is too weak to actually solicit a successful resolution for the families, the Palestinian families of Sheikh Jarrah. But at the same time, this is an entire legal system that is built on ensuring the erasure of Palestinians. So, of course, the case is going to be too weak. I think it would have been false to also assume that the Attorney General of Israel would help in bringing out any other result for Palestinians.
So right now, what does this mean for people like, well, the Palestinian twins, Muna and Mohammed? They were arrested yesterday. First Muna and then Mohammed turned himself in. What were they interrogated about? They have been released since.
They have been released since then. And in terms of the interrogation, well, the charges that they are that are being put in front for the twins, who are 23 years old, is participating in activities which impact the security of the state of Israel and in participating in riot acts with a nationalistic motive. And let's emphasize on this. This nationalistic motive is basically any Palestinian saying we're Palestinian, especially for those who hold Israeli citizenship or Jerusalem ID. Israel's interrogation tactics are for intimidation. They are for coercion. And often they have Palestinians sign false confessions in Hebrew, knowing very well that the person in front of them, the Palestinian, doesn't speak Hebrew. So it's not just Mohammed and Muna al-Kur. This is the same tactic that's being used against all Palestinians. Two others were also arrested with them. Iyad Abu Sneneh and Zuhair Rajabi, who are from Silwan. And it shows you how Israel is targeting all Palestinian neighborhoods that are confronting their forced expulsion.
Some people might be very surprised to hear all of this. They might be saying, wait a second, I thought there was a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza, that the violence is over. That's how it's described in the mainstream media. So if you can describe what continues to happen since. You have Mohammed reporting on Saturday that Jewish settlers were throwing stones at his house, that the Israeli police were standing by. If you can talk about the settler-police relationship and also what happened to the Al Jazeera reporter.
Right. So in terms of Gevada Buderi, she was violently attacked by Israeli police in Jerusalem as she was trying to cover the developments happening in Sheikh Jarrah, knowing very well that Israel is trying to give a blackout on Palestinians. And in terms of the ceasefire, this is a ceasefire where Israel agrees not to bomb Gaza, but the besiegement of Gaza continues. The healing and rebuilding and recovery process is inapplicable right now until the siege is lifted and removed. In terms of attacking Palestinians in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in other Palestinian cities such as Haifa and Safad and Akka, it continues. And the Israeli police basically provides protection for settlers, but also joins them in the violence. In 3 weeks ago, you had Israeli police dressed in civilian clothing so they can join the settler mobs chasing Palestinians, screaming death to Arabs. So it's continued. And Gevada Buderi, the Al Jazeera correspondent, who was violently attacked and taken into interrogation despite being pressed. Let's remember Israel bombed Al Jazeera offices, associated press offices in Gaza, on live television. And just yesterday, they threw a stun grenade on another correspondent with Al Jazeera, Najwan Samri, which injured her in the leg. And these violations are just systemic. And we often assume that just because you're in the police, just because you're an Israeli lawyer, you're not participating in the ethnic cleansing, but they're colluding together.
I wanted to go to Gevara herself, the Al Jazeera journalist Gevara Buderi, describing her arrest and the breaking of her hand on Al Jazeera.
They broke my hand. I spent all the night in the hospital. My heart and my back hurt me a lot. And here, my hand from the cuffs. Also, they hurt so much because the soldiers in the car were tightening it all the time. Mm-hmm. I have a headache, and my leg, I can't walk very well.
So if you can also talk about overall the cracking down on Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem inside Israel, thousands of arrests in the last month.
That's true. There have been thousands of arrests. Just this morning, 17 Palestinians were taken into arrest overnight in raids on their homes, where families were beaten, children were terrorized. I know a couple of incidents with friends who are speaking how their children are just completely horrified at the violence of Israeli forces. And this is all coming as part of Israel trying to settle the score, as the police said, for everyone that spoke up against their ethnic cleansing. Israel is criminalizing our right to say we're Palestinian, our right to say we want to live in our homes in dignity, our right to be free. And it is doing it by using legal violence. It is doing it by using economic violence. A lot of the detainment of Palestinians is also so they can fine them or let them pay bail. So they're trying to sustain these horrifying measures by letting Palestinians or forcing Palestinians to kind of cover the expenses of it.
So as we speak, and we just have a minute and a half to go, I wanted to ask you about the forming of this new government. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claiming without evidence, sounding exactly like Trump, that the election was rigged. Trump saying it right about the same time in his first speech that he gave in North Carolina. Netanyahu was saying that the election was marred by the biggest election fraud in the history of any democracy. His remarks drawing comparisons, of course, to Trump. But I wanted to ask you about the new government, the deal that would see far-right politician Naftali Bennett serve as prime minister for 2 years, followed by the opposition leader Yair Lapid for 2 years after that. Bennett previously led the Israeli settler movement in the occupied West Bank, calling for annexation of Palestinian lands, opposes a Palestinian state, has compared Palestinian citizens of Israel to a fifth column.
Right. Well, I think the new, quote-unquote, new government isn't really new. It is just a lot more blunt in its racist measures. It's a lot more blunt in its colonial measures. Let's not forget that Netanyahu used to constantly say that they are the ones that dictate the rules and Palestinians will remain Palestinian subjects. I think we will see a lot more violence right now. It will be in the form of detainment, mass detainment. It will be in the form of criminalizing the Palestinian voices. It will be in the form of the continued impunity of settlers and police that shoot down Palestinians and aren't held accountable. And also, in terms of the settler movement, let's not forget that many of these settler organizations, and they are terrorist organizations, are based out of the U.S. So we need to also look at the role of that in terms of continuing the cycle of violence we're experiencing here.
You heard them in an interview mentioning that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu might be potentially replaced very soon by a new government after being prime minister for 12 years. As you remember, Israel had 4 elections in the last 2 years, and up until now, they haven't managed to create a coalition big enough to replace Benjamin Netanyahu. But that seems to be changing, and it seems that finally different Israeli parties managed to form a coalition big enough to get Benjamin Netanyahu out. Now, this is not a done deal, but if this coalition managed to govern, it would be the first time that a governing coalition would have included an Israeli-Palestinian party. Now, this is not necessarily good, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. Palestinians are not necessarily looking at this as a good move by this Palestinian party. And this is mainly because that coalition is a bizarre grouping of very, very different parties. So to backtrack a little bit before we talk about the current situation, just to understand a little bit about the Israeli system. In Israel, for a party to rule, they have to have 60 seats to govern. Now, no party usually earn enough seats to govern through elections. The most popular party usually gets something around 30 seats. So to govern, the majority party are usually mandated to find a coalition of parties that is big enough and that has collectively 60 seats among them. Now, to talk about the Palestinian politicians in the Knesset is the Israeli parliament. I'm sure you often heard spokespeople and defenders of Israeli apartheid mentioning that Israel is not an apartheid state and is not racist, because even in the parliament you have Palestinian politicians and Palestinian parliamentarians. But if you notice, these Palestinian politicians are always talked about in Western mainstream media, but never talked to. And there's a reason for that, because if they give them a platform, most of them, if not all of them, will tell you exactly what the Israeli state does, because most of them usually are the voice of dissent, and they're continuously vilified. There have been many instances where they've been accused of being terrorists just for speaking up for Palestinians or criticizing the status quo in Israel. These Palestinian politicians are often used as tokens for the pro-apartheid activists to avoid any criticism of the Israeli structure and Israeli system. Another thing it's important to note that Palestinians are never included in a governing coalition. It goes as far as sometimes being part of the rhetoric of the major Israeli parties to reassure the Israeli voter that if they win enough votes, they will never create a coalition that would include the Palestinian parties. It's blatant racism, and it's a constant attempt to exclude Palestinians from the political system. This goes further that even in 2015, the Israeli government even tried to eliminate them completely in a sneaky political decision that did not work at the end. Before 2015, parties had to win at least 2% of the votes to be eligible to win seats in the Knesset. This was not an issue for smaller parties like Palestinian parties, who usually win around 2% and a little bit more. But in 2015, the government, in a suspicious move, decided to raise the threshold to 3.25%. It became clear that this was targeting the smaller parties in the Knesset, especially Palestinian parties, who might not be able to surpass the new threshold of 3.25%. But as I mentioned, this didn't work. When this change happened, all the Palestinian political parties decided to join together and form a coalition. And instead of going to the election separately, each one with their own list of candidates, they went in as one coalition with one list, and they called it the joint list. Now, the joint list included all the Palestinian or Palestinian-focused parties from the whole spectrum of political ideologies. This is why they were divided before, because you have the conservative religious parties, you have the secular parties, you have the leftist communist parties. There's a whole range of political parties. And to be able to remain in the Knesset, they joined together in this coalition. And when they did, there was a lot of excitement about this unification, and they managed to get even more Palestinians to the voting booth. And eventually they managed to win between 13 and 15 seats in every election since. This achievement managed to turn Palestinian parties into a significant bloc. As I mentioned, the bigger parties will get usually around 30 seats. So having 15 seats in your hands normally will turn you into a significant bloc that other bigger parties would approach to form a coalition with. But that never happened, and Palestinians remained outside of the governing coalitions. But something changed in the latest election, where one of the parties of that joint list, the conservative religious party, the United Arab List Party, left the joint list, and they ran alone. They managed to win 4 seats, and the joint list won 6 seats. And Palestinian politicians in Israel were once again divided. This was a brief overview of the situation of Palestinian politicians within the larger Israeli political system. I'm going to take a small break now, and when we come back, we'll look closer into the current situation that potentially might produce a governing coalition that might for the first time include Palestinian parties. And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
ريح ضميري ما في أقرب من هالباب يعني بلا طول تسيري ما شاء الله حوله عمله جملين بيمرق منه ماشي ذهابا وإياب ساعة
سلم على كل الجيل سلمني 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 قلياني حبك حارق ومفكر قلبي سارق واني ما بقدر نام في ظل الوضع الطارئ شو بتلبق لك هالقصة تسلم لي سبحان الخالق شو رأيك تحلق هلأ صار لك فترة مش حارق نايما تسلم لي تسلم لي صار لي بقول لك اسبوع لا بفيدك انه تقاوم ولا رح تنفع لدموع منك رامي ولا يعني كاين احسان الموضوع الله مع دواليبك اوعى تنسى تزمر عالكوع
شو بدك ترجع؟
ممنوع
اكيد اريحك بس انه اهم شيء
Benjamin Netanyahu's rivals have united to form a new coalition. After four inconclusive elections in 2 years, is this the end for Israel's longest-serving leader? And with the recent conflict in Gaza, will anything change for the Palestinians? Israel's fragile coalition is preparing for its first test of survival, and the man it's trying to push from power is not going without a fight. Benjamin Netanyahu has accused his old allies turned rivals of selling out to form the new coalition, which includes hardline right-wingers, liberals and, historically, a Palestinian-Israeli party. Netanyahu is trying to woo potential defectors away before the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, holds a confidence vote. First, let's take a quick look at the main players in this alliance of political opposites. Naftali Bennett, who comes from the same right-wing politics as Benjamin Netanyahu and opposes any future Palestinian state. Under the coalition deal, he's become prime minister first, before handing over to Yair Lapid after 2 years. His centre-left party holds more seats than Naftali Bennett's, but it's believed he was willing to go second in order to hold the coalition together. And Mansour Abbas, who heads the Conservative United Arab List, his inclusion in cabinet would be a first for a party representing Palestinian Israelis. Abbas says it'll give them a real voice in government.
As you heard from the clip, a new development happened in the current Israeli political situation, where it seems that several parties managed to create a coalition that could govern and that could potentially, if it succeeded to go all the way, would replace the current Israeli prime minister who has been governing for 12 years. Now, this coalition has been the subject of a lot of surprise and discussions because it is a coalition of very different parties. As the clip mentioned, you have the party of Naftali Bennett. This is a very right-wing pro-settler party that is even more right-wing than Benjamin Netanyahu. You have the party of Yair Lapid, who is more on the centrist side of the political spectrum. Now, it's always important to understand when we talk about politics, it's all relevant to the general environment. So a centrist party in Israel is operating within an apartheid context. So when it comes to Palestinian, the centrist parties are really more right-wing. They're all supportive of occupation, apartheid, and so on. So centrist within a context of apartheid becomes a very relevant term. The third participants in that coalition that is being discussed is the Palestinian party that joined. As we talked about before the clips, this is a conservative religious party that separated from the joint list, and now it is joining this new coalition government. Before we get more into the Palestinian reaction to the United Arab League joining this very controversial coalition, and also before we get into the Palestinian perspective on this new change and if they believe this coalition and this new government will do any changes for them, I'm going to play a clip from Inside Stories discussing more this coalition and if it's sustainable and what could potentially threaten its unity.
There we are. Here we go. Let's bring in our guest from Tel Aviv. We have Neri Zilber, adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Muin Rabbani. He joins us from The Hague today. He's co-editor of the Jadalia online magazine, which is produced by the Arab Studies Institute. Neri Zilber in Tel Aviv, coming to you first. Is Mr. Bennett a pragmatist or an ideologue?
Well, Mr. Bennett is an ideologue who has, by force of necessity, become a pragmatist. And the clearest indication of that is his agreement to actually form this rather diverse and ideologically diverse, definitely, coalition government. It's not something he would have done in years past. I was also skeptical, even just last week, that he wouldn't have taken the path of less resistance and actually cut a deal with Bibi Netanyahu and merged with the Likud. But we saw him take, I would argue, a more courageous path in his mind and in many people's minds here in Israel for the greater good, for the greater good of the country and ending Netanyahu's long reign.
Muin Rabbani in The Hague, what's the difference between Mr. Bennett and Mr. Netanyahu? Where's the clear blue water between these two?
I think the short answer is it's the same old rancid wine in new bottles. And I think most people will accept that this is essentially a personal dispute or a power struggle between two claimants to the Israeli prime ministership rather than a change of government on the basis of any important policy or ideological differences. And I think the real question concerns the longevity of this government, given the breadth of the coalition that is expected to take power. And secondly, whether Prime Minister Netanyahu will manage to remain eligible for public office and unseat it and form a potentially new coalition after elections, or whether he'll be removed, in which case the possibility of a new right-wing coalition, including the Likud, but without Netanyahu, becomes entirely possible. But as far as the bigger issues are concerned, I certainly wouldn't expect any difference.
Neri Zilber, coming back to you there in Tel Aviv, when you talk to, I'm loath to use the expression, when you talk to ordinary Israelis, are they content that for the first time ever now we have Arab representation in the coalition? Yes, we've had Arab representation in the Knesset, but not in coalition government. For ordinary, perhaps even particularly the younger Israelis, but do they think that's a good idea or a bad idea, having Arab representation at the top table?
Well, it depends which Israelis you ask. We have to remember that despite the potential now formation of a new government, this is still a deeply divided country, almost 50-50. Netanyahu, we should remember, only didn't succeed in gaining that narrow right-wing religious government by some 70,000 votes, two seats in parliament. So we're not talking about wide margins here. But I think, to your point, the official representation of an Arab-Israeli political party in an Israeli governing coalition is historic, it's positive. The irony, if that's the right word, is that Bibi Netanyahu himself put this on the table in the past month or two. He started negotiations with this very same Arab-Israeli Islamist party, Ra'am. And so he, by his very attempt to gain his own government, actually brought the Arab-Israeli political parties into the fold. And, you know, whether he likes it or not now, they helped oppose him.
Muin Rabbani in The Hague, to go back to your point of shelf life or longevity, the numbers at the moment really, really don't stack up in favour of Mr. Bennett having a long shelf life, do they? I mean, he's got, what, 7 out of 120 seats in the Knesset. Is that why certain politicians are already putting on full display for everyone to see around the region the tensions that already exist?
I think it's important to recognize this is essentially an eight-party coalition. And the only thing the eight parties were able to agree upon is the removal of Benjamin Netanyahu from office. And on virtually every other issue, particularly the more important issues, there's no consensus whatsoever. So the question really becomes, once they've achieved their common objective, assuming that they indeed do so during the next week, what happens then? My suspicion is that they will plod along, basically continuing the policies of the current government without changing them in any substantial way, one way or the other. And at the same time, bear in mind, it has only a razor-thin majority within the Israeli parliament. And all you need is Netanyahu, assuming he remains a leader of the Likud, inciting against it day and night as a, you know, left-wing government beholden to the Arabs and all the rest of it. And it's I think, fairly conceivable that it won't take too long before you get one or two parliament members from one of the right-wing parties defecting. Next thing you know, you have a no-confidence motion, and it's back to square one.
Commenting on what Mr. Rouhani said, the biggest issue that will keep this coalition together is Netanyahu as opposition leader. So long as the threat of Netanyahu toppling this new government and returning to power exists, increases the likelihood of the government actually surviving.
It seems to me now...
If I could just very briefly respond to the previous point. I agree about Netanyahu being the glue that holds this coalition together. The question becomes, what happens if Netanyahu is deposed as opposition leader, which is, I think, a realistic possibility.
You heard in this interview the guest from Tel Aviv mentioning two things that I want to address or nuance a little bit. The first thing he mentions that it's good news, according to him, that Naftali Bennett accepted to join this coalition and to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, good news is relative, depending from what perspective you're looking at it. I want to mention a point that was discussed by an article on 972 Mag. And they say, and I'm quoting, while replacing Netanyahu has been a long-time goal for many on the left, most of the top positions in the new government will likely be filled by former Netanyahu allies. So let's go over this list to get a sense about who can potentially, again, all of this is potentially, we're still not 100% sure this coalition will survive, but if it does, who can potentially replace Netanyahu and his government? First, you have Naftali Bennett that we mentioned. He will be first aligned to become prime minister for the first 2 years. Naftali Bennett used to be a member of Netanyahu's political staff. He is the former head of the Yesha Council for West Bank Settlements. He also leads the far-right group Yamina, which is a national religious party deeply committed to Jewish supremacy and the annexation of large swaths of the occupied territories. While Naftali Bennett will become prime minister, his longtime political partner, Ayelet Shaked, will become the interior minister. Ayelet Shaked was also a former member of Netanyahu's political staff. According to the article, she is deeply committed to the deportation of African asylum seekers from Israel. She will also have the power to deepen discrimination against Palestinian municipalities. A third position that is worth mentioning is the finance minister. This one will be run by Avigdor Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman as well used to be the chief of staff of Netanyahu. He's a far-right secular nationalist who, according to the article, has spent the last few years rebranding himself as a liberal, and he seems to be succeeding at it. Lieberman is himself a settler who has built his career on inciting hatred against the two poorest communities in Israel. First, the Palestinian citizens, and second, the ultra-Orthodox. Another very important position to mention is the justice minister, and this one will be filled by Gideon Saar. Gideon has expressed his support for formal annexation. He also supported the deportation of asylum seekers, among other things. While Gideon Saar will be the justice minister, another member of his party will run the education minister, and another member will become the Knesset speaker. All these three people used to be members of the Likud, which is Benjamin Netanyahu's party. Final position to talk about is the defense minister, which will be filled by Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz used to be the IDF chief of staff who led the assault on Gaza in 2014. And Benny Gantz is the current minister of defense with Benjamin Netanyahu. So he's part of the current government. And because of that, that makes him not only close to Netanyahu, but also responsible of the latest attack on Gaza that happened last month. So you can see from this lineup, there's not a lot of change. Sometimes it's even going further to the right. So to mention that this new coalition will create a government that might bring change or this is good news, it really depends from where you're looking at it and from what perspective you're analyzing this new change in Israeli politics. Before I talk about the second point that I wanted to address and that was mentioned in the previous interview I played, we're going to take a small break and we will be back addressing a point that has to do with the participation of Palestinians in this controversial coalition.
Talk about, for the first time, the United Arab List joining this coalition that would rule.
Right. So at this point, what we need to look at is the demands of Palestinians for justice and freedom. Anyone that doesn't represent that, we need to look at as aiding and abetting Israeli apartheid and persecution of Palestinians. So sometimes we might get misguided in the labels, but in the end, let's look at the reality on the ground, on the actions on the ground, and holding accountability for Palestinians against the criminals that are perpetuating this.
We just heard from Maryam Marghouti, a Palestinian researcher from the Occupied West Bank, responding to a question concerning the decision by the United Arab List, a Palestinian conservative religious party in Israel, to join the new coalition that is hoping to replace Benjamin Netanyahu. You can see from her response, Palestinians are not very excited with that news. She even considered that as being complicit with the crimes that are being committed against Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. So when we hear from the previous guest of the previous interview I played, when we hear him describe this decision as good news, it's important always to ask good news for who? Is it really good news for Palestinians? According to Al Jazeera, Mansour Abbas, who is the leader of the United Arab List, explained his decision to join the coalition. He says, and I'm quoting, "We decided to join the government in order to change the balance of political forces in the country." He also claims that the agreement includes the allocation of more than $16 billion to improve infrastructure and combat violent crimes. He also adds that it includes provisions to freeze demolitions of homes built without permits in Palestinian villages and to grant official status to Bedouin towns in the Negev desert. Now, many people are very skeptical that any of this will happen, especially that this coalition include extremely racist right-wing politicians that have been openly committed to their racist supremacist ideologies against Palestinians and others. Palestinians in occupied West Bank and Gaza are even seeing this as them siding with what they see as the enemy. Badri Karam, who's from Gaza, he asked, and I'm quoting, "What will he do when they ask him to vote on launching a new war on Gaza? Will he accept it? Will he be part of the killing of Palestinians?" Unquote. But that's a very good question. How can you be part of the apartheid government that subjugates your own people? You will eventually make decisions that will allow the subjugating of these people. Analysts are seeing the decision by Mansour Abbas as self-serving, that was only for his own political ambition and political gains, and did not really take into consideration the larger issues that Palestinians are dealing with on a daily basis. Next, I will play another part of the interview from Inside Story, where the guest from Al Shabaka is discussing or explaining if he thinks this new coalition that includes this Palestinian party will be useful really to Palestinians in any shape or form.
Listening to what you guys have been saying over the past 10 minutes or so, that any moves forward in the right direction for the Palestinians, don't hold your breath for that to happen anytime soon, because it's not going to happen.
If you look at this from a Palestinian perspective, I believe that decades of bilateral diplomacy under exclusive U.S. supervision have left all but two, perhaps three Palestinians convinced that the prospect of achieving their rights on the basis of decisions taken by the Israeli government are no more realistic, and that therefore a different formula needs to be found to achieve both Palestinian rights and Israeli-Palestinian peace, and that is essentially through the internationalization of the question of Palestine, taking it back to its origins, so to speak, and seeking to generate both external pressure on Israel and trying to broaden the international sponsorship of any potential negotiations beyond Israel's primary and strategic ally, the United States.
But Muin Rabbani, when you say a different formula, that's got to surely by definition be a different formula kind of wrapped around the same people. So you would still have Israel and an interlocutor, say the United States, Mahmoud Abbas, criticized for being low energy right enough.
Yes, but, you know, let's leave Mahmoud Abbas, the increasingly obsolete and I suspect not much longer lasting Palestinian leader, out of the picture for the moment, because as we've seen in recent weeks, he's being rapidly overtaken by his own people, who are seeking to overcome the fragmentation, political, geographic and otherwise. It's been a hallmark of the Oslo process. And I think what Palestinians are increasingly seeking to do is not relying on bilateral negotiations with Israel, where Israel, in effect, has a power of veto over each and every Palestinian right and its implementation, but seeking to generate external international pressure on Israel to ensure that Israel is left with no choice but to respect and implement Palestinian rights. It's going to be a very difficult and lengthy process. But part of it, I think, is also is going to depend on broadening international involvement in any potential diplomacy besides the United States. I think it's unrealistic to suggest that the United States is not going to be involved. But a situation where the United States is the only external party involved and has, you know, basically set up the process so that it meets Israeli interests at the expense of Palestinian rights and does so systematically, is no longer really something that Palestinians are willing to accept.
Mr. Netanyahu is in effect at ground zero of a legal process going through the courts just now, questions and accusations surrounding what he did or what he didn't do allegedly when he is Israeli prime minister. There's another legal process going on across the road in the Israeli Supreme Court to do with illegal settlements. And the fact of that process displays to the world, the broader region as well, that the whole settlement machine keeps on rolling. Mr. Bennett surely, presumably, will not pull the plug on that.
No, he won't. But it remains to be seen what overall policy the new Israeli government formulates with regard to settlement construction in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Issawi Frij, an Arab-Israeli lawmaker from the left-wing Meretz Party, who's set to be a minister for regional cooperation, put it best publicly 2 days ago. He said this will be a status quo government. In other words, don't expect a major breakthrough, two-state solution, and everybody dancing in the streets. But on the other hand, don't expect us to go crazy, as he put it, in the settlements. And so how you thread that needle, I think, will say a lot about the new Israeli government and, more to the point, the staying power of the new Israeli government.
Moon Rabbani, very briefly, you get the last 45 seconds of the program. You are not the first guest we've had on this channel to say that Mahmoud Abbas is a bit low energy and he's probably heading for the political exit. If the Palestinians deserve higher energy leadership in the PA, if the PA is about to have to engage or want to engage with an Israeli government, where will that come from and who will that person be?
Well, what we're seeing now is that it's coming from Palestinians on the ground, and it's coming from Palestinians everywhere, whether in Israel, in Gaza, in the West Bank, Jordan, Lebanon, and so on. And I think we're really at a pivotal moment and a moment of opportunity. Of course, it's not going to be a very long-lasting moment, but the Palestinian priority now should be, and I believe is, to reunify themselves so that they can develop a meaningful strategy implemented by credible leadership, precisely because the status quo has become unbearable. And as we saw in the last month, one can call for a maintenance of the status quo, but it will be overtaken by events.
We established during the show that this potential new government in Israel might not bring any changes for Palestinians, and the current lineup of ministers seems to be even more right-wing than Netanyahu. But 972 Mag, in its article that I referenced earlier, they ended by listing a couple of potential, maybe positive things that could happen from this new bizarre alliance between the far right and the Zionist left and the Palestinian political party. They say, and I'm quoting, in the immediate future, replacing the current far-right government with one that relies on the Zionist left might still have some benefits, mostly in terms of slowing down the country's political shift to the right. In addition, the inclusion of Palestinian Party, even if it's a conservative religious one, into the ruling coalition is a break from decades of Jewish-only rule and the collapse of the assumption that Palestinian citizens have no seat at the table. This could change the discourse and inspire a different political imagination. So this is the couple of positive points that 972 Mag argued that might actually be beneficial, at least in the immediate future. It remains to be seen if any of this really will have a major influence and impact on a larger scale. Now, beyond the change in Israeli government, if we go back to the wider image, there are a couple of positive things that are happening that are bringing a lot of hope to a lot of Palestinians and Palestine solidarity communities. One, that we're seeing a wave of Palestinian popular resistance from the river to the sea, which is uniting Palestinians all over historic Palestine. So Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, Palestinians living in occupied West Bank, Palestinian in East Jerusalem, and Palestinian in the occupied, sieged Gaza. Another positive shift that we have discussed a couple of shows ago, it's concerning the U.S. public opinion and policies toward Israel that seems to be rapidly shifting. If this shift continues, this might lead eventually to an actually significant pressure being put on the Israeli government. A last point I want to mention, because we're talking about U.S. public opinion and policies potentially shifting. Despite the shift, one thing that we might want to keep an eye on is how Israel is discussed. During the latest attack on Gaza and the latest ethnic cleansing and violence in East Jerusalem and West Bank, we saw a shift, and we saw American media and politicians criticizing the Israeli government. But sometimes we also saw within that criticism a reframing of the problem, a reframing to make it look like this is a Netanyahu problem. Palestinians right now are suffering because Netanyahu is this far-right racist politician. And that reframing is dangerous. The situation of Palestine exceeds and extends beyond Netanyahu and existed way before Netanyahu and Hamas and so on. It's a situation of apartheid, colonization, occupation, blockade, ethnic cleansing, and all the things we mention and talk about on the show. It's important to make sure that we don't let progressive take this back door, allowing themselves to be critical so they don't look complicit, but at the same time refusing to address the root of the problem and making it look just a Netanyahu problem or just a right-wing rising problem. The same way a lot of liberals in the U.S. made it look like the U.S. problem is a Donald Trump problem, and as soon as he's gone, the U.S. quote is back. The U.S. was never a structure of justice to begin with. Donald Trump didn't create it, might have exasperated momentarily, but getting rid of Donald Trump doesn't go back to a status quo that is good. That's the same thing with Israel. Getting rid of Benjamin Netanyahu does not mean we go back to the status quo that is supposed to be good, as if Israel will cease to be an apartheid state after Netanyahu is gone and will cease to be an occupier and will cease its ethnic cleansing and oppression of Palestinians. All of these things started way before Netanyahu. We saw a little bit, a hint of that reframing from key political progressive voices, mainly Bernie Sanders. I will next play a clip from an interview with Bernie Sanders on mainstream media when they asked him to comment about the escalation of violence in Israel-Palestine.
So you got a total disaster there. And I think that what the function of what where we should be, especially when we're giving $4 billion a year to Israel, is we should be bringing people together, not just being one-sided and say everything that Israel does is good, because it is not. Over the years, Netanyahu and his government have become much more right-wing. You have overt racists who are now part of Netanyahu's coalition. And what the United States has got to say is, look, it's a difficult situation. It's gone on for decades. No magical answer. But you guys are going to have to come together and develop a long-term plan that provides dignity for the Palestinian people, safety for the Israeli people. We've got to be pro-Israel. We've got to be pro-Palestinian. Criticizing the government of Israel does not make you anti-Semitic any more than it makes you pro-Hamas if you talk about the terrible destruction now taking place in Gaza. Look, we have Trump is gone, and I hope to see a new face in our foreign policy, and that is an approach that brings the world together. And in the Middle East, it is difficult, Seth. I mean, good people have worked on this issue for decades without success. But the current situation is unsustainable. If you have massive misery and 70% youth unemployment in Gaza, do you doubt for a second that there will be more and more unrest? So we have got to figure out a way to bring Israel and the Palestinians together. Understand that Hamas, it's not only a terrorist organization, it is corrupt, it is ineffective, and they do not reflect, I think, the wishes of the Palestinian people. And in Israel, to complicate the problem, you have a government more and more right-wing under Netanyahu. So this is not easy stuff, but as the most powerful nation on earth, we've got to do our best to bring people together and finally bring peace to that troubled region.
These are the comments made by Bernie Sanders during an interview he gave last month during the latest escalation of violence in Israel-Palestine. There are a couple of good things in his comments. First, he acknowledged that the U.S. is one-sided. He also acknowledged that Palestinians have rights too. He acknowledged as well that criticizing a government does not make you a bigot. But these good things are very generic, basic things to acknowledge. On the other side, his comments were, in the best-case scenario, incomplete, in the worst-case scenario, misleading. For example, he continuously created a false equivalence between both parties. He also continuously repeated that this is, quote, a complicated issue, which is the usual thing repeated when attempting to avoid describing and talking about what is actually happening in Israel-Palestine, which politicians are very aware of. He even talked about how, quote, good people have been trying to solve this issue for decades, but they failed because apparently this, quote, troubled land is again too complicated. There were no, quote, good people who have been trying and trying from the goodness of their heart to solve the issue, but failed because it's again too complicated. There were only imperialists interfering in Middle Eastern affairs for their own interest. Trying to frame the U.S. role in the misery of Palestinians throughout decades in such a way is nothing but a continuation of an imperialist misleading rhetoric, not to mention very simplistic. For people who are still confused, Biden, which is the current president of the United States, explained it very clearly in a statement he gave in the 80s.
If we look at the Middle East, I think it's about time we stop, those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel.
So at the end, it is not that complicated. At least for our purposes here in the West, it is very simple what we can do. We have to stop defending, supporting, and funding criminal regimes, whatever they are, and whenever that suits our interests. As long as we continue with this ideological, morally bankrupt approach, we can't claim after that this is too complicated for us to understand and deal with, and use that as an excuse to avoid the topic. We do understand what is going on, because many times we funded ourselves, we supported ourselves, we helped spread the propaganda of these criminal regimes to our people, and many times we even created ourselves. In his comments, Bernie Sanders also reframed the entire situation as a Netanyahu problem. He even went as far as representing the situation as an escalation and a conflict between two extremist governments on both sides. With that statement, he created false equivalents and gave the impression that this is an equal fight between two governments on equal footing. So it's important to pay attention when progressive politicians and media superficially criticize what's going on in Israel-Palestine, while at the same time reinforcing rhetorics that have been spread throughout decades. And that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. My name is Sausan Kadura. Thank you very much for listening. Make sure to tune in next week. And until then, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Radio Show est une émission radio avec des nouvelles pour les prisonnières et leurs alliés et familles. L'émission cherche à confronter l'invisibilité des prisons et la lutte des prisonnières en se concentrant sur la racine de l'incarcération, de la police et de la criminalisation. Nous sommes dédiés à des programmes qui collaborent directement avec des personnes actuellement incarcérées. Dans cet esprit, nous aimerions vous faire savoir qu'on a une ligne téléphonique pour les prisonnières et leurs amis et familles. Vous pouvez nous appeler Collect de la prison de Bordeaux et de la prison Rivière-des-Prairies en composant le numéro 514-876-3748. Encore une fois, c'est 514-876-3748 pour les appels Collect. On a aussi un numéro normal qui est 438-337-8423. N'hésitez pas à appeler ce numéro et à nous laisser un message avec des nouvelles à partager sur l'émission ou un message audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur.
Go. You love to talk when we